I get increasingly cynical about politics the more I understand identity formation and culture, because so much of ideology is self-justifying. That I need this value for my identity, and therefore I'm going to find the ideology that supports it.
Hello, I am Cody Allingham, and this is The Transformation of Value, a place for asking questions about freedom, money, and creativity. Today, I'm joined by David Marks. David is an American author living in Japan. He writes about fashion and culture, and his work has appeared in The Atlantic, The New Yorker, and The New Republic. David's books include Ametora, How Japan Saved American Style, as well as Status and Culture, How Our Desire for Social Rank Creates Taste, Identity, Art, Fashion, and Constant Change. Most recently, David has written Blank Space, A Cultural History of the 21st Century. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you. You're having me.
With your new book, Blank Space, you have undertaken the mammoth task of assessing the cultural landscape of the first 25 years of this century. You ask us to consider why, even though there is more cultural output than ever in the realm of music, film, and the visual arts, there is still this overwhelming sense of stagnancy. Mm-hmm. As you write, where society once encouraged and provided an abundance of cultural invention, there is now a blank space. Now, I think one way we can begin to understand this is to follow the money. And ultimately, this leads to an encounter with neoliberalism. Mm-hmm. I think we can start our discussion there then, in terms of neoliberalism and how it has flowed into the cultural logic of the 21st century. What do you think?
Okay, so I think there are multiple factors going on. And the thing about when you write these books, there's the industry pressure to, you write a book that has a really simple point that I could just tell you one sentence and then be done. Because a cultural ecosystem is quite complicated, and these issues of abundance of creativity and what we mean by creativity and art and culture, I mean, these are all very ambiguous words. So it's a kind of difficult discussion. The economic factors, let's say that there's some raw economic factors. So one of the clearest ones would be for films. So as films become more and more expensive to promote, that puts more and more pressure on a studio to make something that can not only connect with Americans. So, you know, so many films are from Hollywood. It used to be that the American movie market was enough. Now they know in order to make their money back, they need to also connect with the Chinese market and these other markets. So you have to do things. You have to make films that aren't insular inside jokes or too based off of American urban culture. And you need things that guarantee that you're going to make your money back. And especially especially the financial crisis, the banks started demanding that they would be able to finance films. And they wanted to make sure that the films were going to guarantee a return. And so the answer to all these problems is doing IP. And so that's something that had already started. But if we're going to do IP, or if we're going to buy Lucasfilms, let's take Star Wars and turn it into three more movies and TV shows. And so then you get, rather than a new kind of Star Wars, so a new series or a new world, you just get more Star Wars. You get the Marvel Cinematic Universe. You get Smurfs 2, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's one where it's very easy to say, like, the economics and just global capital and capital needing return on culture, and culture tends to not be always predictable in terms of what hits and what doesn't, that they've tried to make it as predictable as possible, and that's led to some of the stagnancy. So that's the direct, let's say, an example of direct economic impact.
Okay.
Then you can have the fact that the economy is now driven and centralized on these technological platforms, and those platforms, more or less, because of their advertising models, need as many people as possible to be providing free content, and they're not in the business of telling people what it is that they should be watching, or they don't have to mobilize resources to say, we can make 10 TV shows, should the TV shows be? They say, you all make the content and we'll monetize it for you. So obviously they don't get in the way between what's popular or not. And so it pushes content to be a little more amateur and a little less sophisticated, and it almost never goes beyond the audience because it needs to aggregate as many audiences as possible to monetize. So then the content that's created on a YouTube or TikTok has a certain kind of logic to it that is different than the logic of an indie film or a weird TV show that somehow got greenlit in the 1990s. So, I mean, we can start with there. I mean, there's like the spiritual ideological side of this, but in terms, you can already see just that if you take the most dogmatic, straightforward Marxian look at the culture is just this thing that pops out of the industries, and the industries have their own logic. You can already see that the industry itself is pushing TV shows and movies. I mean, TV shows are a little more controversial in the sense that there's been good TV shows, but movies and music in particular seem to be kind of moving in one direction. But I think the main thing to me, and this is what's really important, is that mass culture in previous eras has also been quite stagnant and maybe not the best source of the greatest creativity. So I don't think you can just look at the Marvel Cinematic Universe and say, well, that's the end of culture. There's the fact that it's gone beyond that, I think, is the main issue at hand.
Okay, that's fascinating. I think it's an interesting situation that neoliberalism, which really got kicked off in the mid-1980s, my entire life is sort of encapsulated in that period of time. And when I talk to my grandparents around, you know, what New Zealand was like before that, which was very much in the vein of embedded liberalism, you know, the state did many things. There wasn't things like Kmart or, you know, big box retailers,
right,
you know, where you could buy clothes back in not that far ago. You know, I mean, this was sort of maybe the 1960s, you know, my grandmother's still making clothes for my mother and her sisters. And so it's sort of, this project really unfolded at quite a rapid pace. It's so present in our life now that we've sort of forgotten what other modes of existence were like. And I wonder whether you consider it, again, just at the highest level, this period of you know, post-war embedded liberalism, where you had, you know, these periods with quite clear genres emerging. You know, for example, I mean, pre-war jazz bands, you know, they just basically went out of style almost immediately after the war ended. You had these periods of time that really demarcated genres and music styles, and you could see the tastes unfolding as they happened. But now, you know, it's all sort of come together, and we don't have that anymore. And how much of that is related to maybe the dominance of broadcast media, of the distribution mechanisms? How much of that are we returning to maybe a more natural state where, I guess, the cultural outputs are a little bit more niche and long tail?
If you go back and you can say, okay, there was a cultural production before neoliberalism, and let's blame the film studios and, again, the consolidated content industry for some of these problems. The fundamental problem, if you look at the 20th century, is it is not necessarily, again, the output of those systems where you're like, well, let's take film, for example. Okay, so there was a lot of really bad films made by the industry, even though it was not neoliberal and less consolidated. The lack of consolidation also opened it up so that independent studios like what Coppola was doing, or, you know, people who sponsored Scorsese, I mean, they can make films, right? So there's more adult films. But the other thing is just more people watching films. So if you have any industry in which more people are watching it, you have more opportunity for things on the niche side to prosper. So again, I think that the issue here is not a question of, can the culture industry supply all the creativity we need? Because the answer to that is almost always no. And if you look at the 20th century and you look at what do we actually care about? So if you think about jazz, you think about rock and roll, hip hop, any of the counterculture things that came out of the 60s, punk, all of those movements were created on the margins. And so punk is not, thanks to the studio, because the studio was less of a conglomerate, we got punk. I think that, you know, what happened was on the margins. So the thing I really focus on in the book is the value shift that's happened in the 21st century. And that value shift is that people care a lot more about making money, and not because they're greedy, and not because unnecessary, even that they feel that they need to make more money because of, you know, there's fewer social services or all these things, but because the value, cultural value, is just so much more connected with economic value. And people peg their own success and the success of their artworks based off of these more economic metrics. And there's been much more, not just permission, but blessings of culture that is made to make money, that is cynically manufactured in order to make as much money as possible, as being a source of creativity. So if you have Lou Pearlman, who is a fraudster and dies in prison, but he had seen New Kids on the Block and said, wow, that makes a lot of money. I'm gonna do my own thing. It's gonna be called the Backstreet Boys. And we're gonna make the Backstreet Boys. And then I'm gonna make NSYNC and not even tell the Backstreet Boys I'm making NSYNC, because I'm just trying to create as many of these things as possible and then launder the money through a jet program in order to do all this, you know, financial machinations. Then you know, what pops out of this is the Backstreet Boys. And they work with Max Martin, and then they create I Want It That Way. And it's a song that, you know, in the 90s, it was the kind of thing that people made fun of as being like, you know, the worst excesses of pop music. Nobody gave New Kids on the Block respect. And so then you get, Backstreet Boys doing the song and critics going out of their way to say, this is the greatest song of the 21st century. I think it's like 1999 anyway, but okay, it's like one of the great songs of this of the era, the turn of the century. So that's where neoliberalism is turned into a value structure. It's not just that the economics are pushing people to make decisions in the short term for profit, but it's actually infected the way people judge culture, and that's really what the book is about.
Yeah, I think I picked up on that. You're right. Neoliberalism didn't just create pernicious economic structures, it provided a set of extremely seductive ideologies that convinced us to stop idealizing artistic progress. And I think it could perhaps even go a little bit deeper, this question of progress and sort of the idea that we can improve and explore and innovate on things, that there's always some new territory through which we can take things from and explore. And I wonder whether, I mean, you've written quite a lot about the internet before in your other work, and how we've got this access now to so much culture, so much information. We're sort of, I wouldn't say inundated, but we've got so much access that it's hard to maybe put things into what you talk about as the canon of the past, right? The canon of history, and to go back to what came before, to rework it. Not necessarily to copy it, though, to sort of take it as inspiration, but to then do something new with it. And so what are your thoughts on, I guess, how the internet has played into this, which really does line up as well with this timeline of the last 25 years and neoliberalism?
And then another factor is postmodernism, which really starts before either of these things. And postmodernism has been described as the cultural logic of late capital by Frederick Jameson. And so there is a link, I think, also between the movement of capital and then where postmodernism came from. But postmodernism also came from the fact that modernist artists had this dogged conviction that whatever they were going to do was going to be this real progression upon the previous art. And so if art did this one thing, well, we're going to do it this completely different way because that's the right way to do it. And we're going to solve all the problems of the previous movement. And at some point, you just ran out of obvious directions. And so, you know, if art is art is completely abstract, okay, now art, that was too boring. So now art can be commercial with pop art. All right, well, why is art even in a gallery? Art can be earth. Oh, then why is art even permanent? Art can be performance. It should be temporary. You know what? You can always kind of look at the definition of art and keep spinning out of it. But at some point you run out of this, and then these movements kind of ended. And so already by the late 60s, early 70s, you get a lot of theorists saying, well, that era of art where it's kind of a succession of different movements is over. So let's say that's also maybe an ideological thing that came out of capitalism a bit, but also just anytime you have a system and the system's moving towards innovation in one direction, you hit a wall. But I think even postmodern artists believe that they could explore new directions and do things with art. When it gets to the later with kind of, so let's say neoliberalism or globalism, and adding things to the canon. So the internet, I mean, so the first issue is there's a philosopher named Noel Carroll who writes about kind of how you define art. And it's like one of the most annoying questions in the world is like, what is art? But he really gets to art is ultimately whatever's in the narrative of art. So it's kind of the narrative theory of art. So cave paintings, pop art, they're all in the narrative of art. And so what you're trying to do in some way as a creator is put the work you're doing in that narration. And narration has an inherent bias towards the new. So it's the same thing with a newspaper. You wake up every day and the headline isn't things exactly like yesterday. It doesn't matter what it is. There's going to be something that happened and had to happen. And so as the canon is built, not just from quality things, but it's also built from what is new and what's different. And so as we think through, let's say, the 21st century fashion changes, you're going to focus on, well, jeans were really skinny. So why are jeans skinny being interesting is because they were not skinny, right? So they were, got very wide in the late 90s, and then they went skinny, and then everyone was wearing skinny jeans. And so, okay, therefore, that is a fashion style of that era. And so the canon gets naturally built, whether that canon is the thing of like good or bad. The things we remember are built out of difference. And so one of the issues is if these art movements aren't becoming movements anymore, it's very hard for an individual artist to really grow strong enough to get in the canon. Mm-hmm. And then with the internet, things move too quickly and they seem too superficial for us to stop and say, wow, that was really great. And so you could have, there's actually a problem now with so much of the cool stuff we saw online is disappeared. It's something you can't even access some of these things. But also like meme culture is a really good example of a kind of culture that's exciting and that people are participating in. It's quite creative. It can be fun. I mean, I think we all enjoy meme culture. There's nothing to take away from it, but are memes, are they seen as having enough gravitas to mark our cultural memories that we say, okay, those memes were from that era and these memes are for this era, maybe a little bit, but they're just, it's different than a novel or it's different than a TV show or a movie. But then also the culture gets in the canon because of repetition. Without repetition, it disappears. And so the problem with a lot of internet culture is because it happens and then we move on so quickly, it just made it more difficult. So all these factors are I guess the main way I also think about these things is they're not conspiracies. They're all invisible hand mechanisms in the sense of nobody saying, let's make it where nothing gets canonized and the cultural value feels like it's dissipating. It's just that all of these things are all conspiring behind the scenes, again, that's the wrong word to use. They're just all...
it's all happening all the time.
They're all optimizing for something else, and it just happens to not be the thing that we need. And I mean, I guess another point of my book is just to make people aware of these are the issues, and so the system is no longer naturally orienting us towards these outcomes that we seem to want. So if we do want them, we have to actually intervene.
Okay, so a couple of things I have, I guess you could call these skinny jeans. So maybe we're back in that territory. Though I have seen a lot of wide, big jeans around as well. And I do think, man, memes, they do age pretty quickly as well. It's interesting. These cycles are quite fast. But I just wanted to, again, I think anchoring this into neoliberalism is quite interesting. I've been reading through this book, Beyond the New Right, by John Gray, which is a very interesting study of neoliberalism, basically as it was beginning to unfold in the 90s in Britain and much of the world. And he writes, the political thinkers of the new right neglected the historical basis of political allegiance and a shared history and a common culture. They did so because they had imbibed from liberal individualism their neutered fiction of the person, the Kantian subject that lacks any particular identity and has a history only by accident. And I think what we're beginning to pick up, in particular with the United States, but in lots of parts of the world, there's this idea that perhaps over the last 25 years or longer with neoliberalism, with globalism, we've lost a sense of connection to a local identity, a local mm-hmm. history. And we're seeing this emerge with some quite strong political
yep.
ramifications. People on, I guess you could say, traditionally the left and the right starting to really get into a place of physical violence around what it means to belong, around culture. And these are quite important questions, this kind of search for identity. What does it mean to be, from where you grew up, you know, what does it mean to belong to that place,
yep.
to come from that place? And we're seeing this play out in quite a spectacular fashion at the moment. And so kind of are we seeing perhaps in a sense a looping back or a return to asking this question of like, well, who am I in the face of globalism? You know, what does it mean for me to have a local identity and to be a citizen, a person of this community, of a certain religion, whatever? It feels like those are the questions that are driving a lot of this political rhetoric. So how do you sort of think about that, maybe this idea that maybe the neoliberalists thought we could just all become individual consumers in the world, we're all just the same?
At least I can speak for the United States in saying it was very clear that neoliberalism from Clinton onward became the only legitimate form of government and economy, right? And so, you know, Bush didn't stop it. And I would say Obama tried to transcend politics and brought in a lot of people who also were trying to do that kind of nudge free choice architecture things where, okay, we're gonna be slightly patriarchal and that we want these outcomes, but we're not gonna force people to do them. Mm. And so he was, you know, I think Obama was even quite careful about not infringing too much on these basic neoliberal assumptions. And it was very clear that the globalization of the economy was hurting a ton of people
yeah.
in the United States, right? And so if, you know, I take the train from Boston, New York sometimes, and all you do is pass factories that are closed that used to make all these garments. And if you're interested in Made in America, I mean, there's almost no Made in America anything anymore because of the system. And so I guess the main point of this is it became very clear to people that this, whether they knew the word neoliberalism or not, that this economic order was not helping them,
something
supporting
was
happening.
Them.
Yeah. And so what it, that kind of, the way I, because I'm not a politics writer, but a culture writer, but now there's so much overlap between politics and culture, you have to really think about these issues. But it seemed very clear that also the American middle-class majority, especially outside of the coastal cities, increasingly lost some sort of cultural identity. It was hard to say, like, this is what these people are and what they're, not what they like and what they don't like, but the coastal identities became much, much stronger, much more cosmopolitan. And all of TV shows and music and everything seemed to represent those values in really subtle ways. But if somebody from the middle of the country was turning on the television and watching Friends, they're just seeing a bunch of, you know, coastal elites with those coastal elite values. A huge one is just body size, right? That everyone on TV is really thin and people outside of the coastal areas were increasingly not thin. So there was then a identity that developed as a counter to cosmopolitan identity that was just anti-cosmopolitan. And so I think a big question for America right now is, are the, let's say MAGA is a cultural movement, is there a MAGA identity that is truly the thing that the ideologues say that there is, which is like a return to like some sort of connection to a community? Or is it simply that they're just anti-cosmopolitan? So one of the examples I think about all the time, because it's completely nonsensical, is to do a truck that's rolling coal. So you outfit your truck to use coal as the fuel and just spew all this black smoke everywhere. And so the point of that is obviously it makes your community worse and it doesn't make it, it's a ridiculous thing to spend your money on, but you've owned the libs. So if liberals are against global warming and want to prevent coal and these things, we're gonna overemphasize the things that they hate. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy to see Trump's presidency and that regime being very interested in a bunch of actions that just make liberals feel bad, rather than something that brings their community together. And so that's my skepticism about this concept that we're going back to a more localized identity, this kind of, you know, nationalism from 100 years ago, when I don't see the formation of that identity behind right-wing politics. I simply see a need to strike back against cosmopolitan liberals. And cosmopolitan liberals, I think, have, in this kind of weird way, I mean, I call it in the book the omnivore monoculture, which is there's something kind of interesting about how diverse and inclusive liberal culture could be, except for the anti-liberals. That's kind of the one inherent thing, is that you can't put anti-liberals in your liberal culture. But it could take things from everywhere, high and low, in different countries, and all sorts of things. And that becomes in itself a pretty stable identity for people in on the coast. And so then it just creates too much tension with the groups outside of it.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, the rolling coal. I don't think they actually burn coal. They just detune the engines enough that they're really dirty when they're burning the diesel, and it gives that black smoke, right?
Yeah.
So it looks, gives the effect of like an old steam engine,
yeah.
Which is quite an interesting, as you say, because it's kind of in the kind of contrast with, say, the Prius or the electric vehicle,
right,
kind of movement. But this is interesting because this idea of like liberalism, and again, I come back to Beyond the New Right, which, you know, sort of situates, I think maybe the language is important here. We talk about a liberal perhaps today, and it has maybe a certain sense of the left of associations with certain administrations in the US. But certainly the history of liberalism, I mean, is an arena for anybody to participate, as you say, high and low on all sides. And there's actually quite a good book called What's Our Problem? By Tim Urban. I don't know if you've encountered that. And he talks a lot about this. There's kind of, you've got high left, low left, and high right and low right. And it seems as if maybe the MAGA movement gets associated with sort of the low right,
mm-hmm,
and what you've described. But there's certainly a long tradition of economists and theorists and academics on the high right,
mm-hmm,
who are exploring these questions. And quite rightly pointing out the hypocrisy on the other side, I guess you could say, or people who claim to speak for the other side. And so I wonder whether, you know, in a sense, the reduction of everything to a market, of this kind of financialization of all things, if that sort of feeds into a kind of sense of political malaise where we don't, I mean, again, something John Gray speaks of is that, you know, we think that the market solves all problems. We sort of put upon the market this grand mission to solve all our problems. But yet, you know, when has any single solution ever solved anything?
Right.
Politics is just kind of muddling through things. And so I just wonder whether, I don't know, maybe it's kind of linguistics, but, you know, what is, if we've got neoliberalism, what is liberalism? Is there a place that we can return to where there's a reasonable discourse and a reasonable arena for engagement?
Yeah, I get increasingly cynical about politics the more I understand identity formation and culture, because so much of ideology is self-justifying. That I need this value for my identity, and therefore I'm going to find the ideology that supports it. And so it's very difficult also to look at this as simply, we just need more people to absorb this, the same ideologies, or get back to some sort of common ground, because common ground just assumes that everybody who's trying to find that common ground actually would be happy with the outcomes if everybody comes back together. And so in the United States in particular, which is something you don't feel in Japan, is that there is a complete scarcity mindset about everything. And so, you know, for every TV show that, or song that represents liberal values, it's somehow zero sum and taking away from conservatives. And so I think that's the other problem, is that if your goal is the economy seems to be aligned with knowledge workers who tend to be liberal and because they're well-educated, if the cultural and social capital all seems to be aligned with them as well, at least you can take political capital to balance it out. And then also, how can we damage that cultural capital? And how can we, in some ways, humiliate people who are on the left as some sort of rebalancing action? So I don't know how you bring these two groups together through some sort of identity. And I mean, if you go back and read William Faulkner's The Sound of the Fury, there's a character in there that's like this really entitled angry Southern dude, and he's everything he says just sounds like MAGA today. I mean, this is an old problem in the United States. It's just, I think that the economic conditions and the technological conditions have really exacerbated it. But I don't know how you get back to, what I felt like was politics in the year 2000, where it's like I voted for Gore. I had friends who voted for Bush, and it seemed like all we were really arguing about was what should we do with the surplus, the budget surplus? You know, should we put in Social Security or give it back to people, et cetera, et cetera? I mean, these are just trivial issues now, where it does seem to be the political divide is all encompassing, which is that it is your identity. These two groups are first and foremost not political positions, because the political positions can change, as we saw when they murdered this guy in Minnesota who had a gun, who was permitted to have a gun, which is something that even as a very far liberal, I'm not super comfortable with all these gun laws, but he had a gun, and it was not something that people on the right who were gun advocates immediately said, yeah, he was allowed to have a gun. Instead, they said, because he had a gun, we were allowed to murder him. So these positions are always fungible based off of your ideology. And so that makes me really, really skeptical and cynical about how you bring everyone together through an ideology.
Okay, so this is a bit of a funny question, but politics downstream then of culture, or culture downstream of politics, or is it too hard to give us?
Yeah, I mean, I guess whether it's which side is true or not, Steve Bannon and Andrew Breitbart believed very strongly that politics flowed from culture. And they have been architects of the rise of the alt-right. And I mean, that's almost like an old term at this point, but you can't look at the rise of MAGA and not see Steve Bannon and that strategy of saying that politics has to be more cultural. Because, I mean, if you look in the 90s, it was very clear what the cultural divide was between the left and the right, in the sense that what Gingrich and them wanted to do was in some ways erase the entire counterculture, the counterculture's effect on the United States, letting someone like Bill Clinton become president. They were really trying to take that wave and push it back, put the genie back in the bottle. And I think why the right has succeeded in the 21st century is because it's embraced transgressiveness and all these things that were powering the counterculture in the 20th century, and combining that with politics. And so at least at the moment, politics, by becoming downstream from culture, has been really successful.
It's interesting. I reference What's Our Problem, a self-help book for societies by Tim Urban. And he quotes American poet Carl Sandburg, who wrote, "When a nation goes down or a society perishes, one condition may always be found. They forgot where they came from. They lost sight of what had brought them along." And he actually, in this book, Tim Urban gives quite a good history of what you just described with, I guess, the changes that happened from about the 1960s onwards, and sort of, oh, can we do that kind of things that emerged in politics, and the engineering and the kind of scheming that once was maybe more, I guess, in air quotes, a gentleman's agreement, that, you know, there were certain lines that wouldn't be crossed, and those lines are now totally crossed, and people are, you know, way over the edge. And so it's quite interesting that this has happened now, and it didn't fully emerge before. And you sort of wonder, well, what is sort of then the connective tissue coming back to, I guess, the base of society, and sort of what shared traditions have we got to work off? Things are like civil society. Like, what is civil society? You know, forget about television and music, but just the institutions, non-state institutions that we have as part of our society. And I mean, has there been a commensurate decline in those things over time, or has there been other things that have meant that what we call civil society has sort of slowly declined to the point where it's just, you know, two teams fighting each other and nothing else in between?
This is a little less in my wheelhouse, so I can't comment on the specific state of civil society, but I would say that, you know, as the thing I think about a lot is the degree to which being rich, what is that multiple of wealth compared to a normal person? So it used to be rich meant I don't know, making 10x a normal person. Now, if it's a billion x, or, you know, multiple hundreds of millions of x, you just create people in society who are so powerful they can either build their own civil society or their own institutions around them, or in some ways the institutions can't push back again. So I don't know, you know, you can have all these great civil society groups, but I think what Trump has done very intentionally is to dismantle them and to make sure that, you know, it very, very quickly, without even making it illegal. But like, I mean, I just used to watch, or I listen every week to PBS NewsHour or something, and it used to be, you know, provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and that's gone now, you know. And so there's also an attack on civil society because the civil society is professional and it's institutional, and it is trying to do things by rule of law, and it's all these processes that try to bake those liberal values, the liberal with the smallest capital, smallest L possible, into society and make it function. And I think people on the right who want to consolidate power are very smart about knowing that those have to go out of the way.
I always struggle a little bit, and again, I'm, as a non-American, sort of this idea of the left and the right, that, you know, because I mean, clearly a lot of these things emerged under Clinton, and you know, it's from the 90s onwards. It doesn't seem that it's a unique sort of I guess you could say right or Republican thing. It seems intimately connected with this logic of neoliberalism, no matter who you are. And again, it's telling that neoliberalism in New Zealand came out under the Labour Party, which is like the most left. It really, I don't know how much those labels are as relevant as maybe the vertical of the individual. And and in a sense, the individual is what's spoken about in neoliberalism. But really, if you can break out of that and become horrendously wealthy, you cease to be just an individual. You become your own sort of fiefdom in a sense.
Yep.
And I think for me, that's the axis that I always come back to, is that whether you're on the left or the right, there is a I guess a class of person, and perhaps you could look at Marxist ideology here for an idea of what that looks like. But there are power brokers in the world now who, you know, own technology companies, and they own things that are so powerful and that untouchable in a sense, even by traditional political power. So there's sort of, yeah, there's a few things going on in that axis, right?
Yeah.
And I guess I struggle with just a simple critique of it from a Marxist perspective, though, because I think that eventually comes back to maybe a politics of resentment. Historically, there's, you know, Marxism has that within it. But clearly something has been engineered over the last 25 to perhaps say the last 40 years under neoliberalism to create structurally a system where, you know, we've got all these individuals that are globalized, and maybe the culture has been washed out. Their jobs have been outsourced. They've been reduced to economic units. At the same time, we talk about civil society, but the idea of like a national identity, national culture, that's starting to fall away. And now we're dealing with the outcomes of that, which is that we've got this kind of this strata, which I don't think is a very liberal idea at all, right? Having stratas of people like that. So I know there's a lot of stuff I've just said, but I mean, how do you sort of look at that? So left and right versus...
I mean, the thing I think about a lot is simply, let's say, old money versus new money, which is one of the oldest conflicts in society, right? And it's just that capitalism creates more opportunities for new money. And late capitalism, and especially where we are now, and especially with the technological revolution we live through, created some of the greatest opportunities for new money ever. And so Zuckerberg can go from quitting Harvard to being a multi-billionaire before getting to his 30s. And that is massively distorting on culture and society in many reasons. So if you are a millennial and you are Zuckerberg's age, it is very difficult to not see the possibility of becoming a Zuckerberg level billionaire within your abilities, right? And so when I left school in 2001, even 2001, if you asked me to name billionaires, I could probably only name a couple, but you know, Bill Gates was the one that I could name. And the thing about Bill Gates that we all felt, because if you, especially if you're a Mac user at the time, and Steve Jobs had not yet kind of become the, you know, global hero that he became, but there was a sense that Steve Jobs changed computing. He created the you know, through Macintosh, the thing that Windows then copied, and then Windows made a way worse version, and then they made all the money because of chicanery, or because he had figured out how to just make a worse product. And so Bill Gates got rich from this thing, but that Steve Jobs was the genius. And that was about it. But the idea that I, graduating from school, had a responsibility to myself to become a billionaire in order to self-actualize.
You have to hustle, man.
Yeah, it just didn't make any sense. I mean, nobody thought that way. And so even the kids who were the greedy kids, the idea was they would go work for Goldman Sachs and they would make $1 million a year. You know, that was seen as like, whoa. And if you go back to Bonfire of the Vanities or something, you know, it's the same. The idea, you know, you can't live on $1 million a year. That's kind of from that book. But the idea is that you still, you know, I don't know, $5 million, $10 million. But these were not billionaires. So suddenly Zuckerberg, now you can be a billionaire. So it's, I think it's the one, so you've got the conflict of Bezos and Musk and Zuckerberg and all these people being billionaires and having their thumb on the scales. I sometimes worry less about that. I worry less about, is X right wing or not? You know, those kind of issues to me seem like there's enough counterbalance that it's not the end of the world. It's simply that their existence messes up how people think about their own lives. And there's no middle zone where it's like, okay, well, I know what I'm supposed to be. I'm not going to be a Zuckerberg, but I could, this is what I should aim for. And this is what a comfortable life costs and looks like. I think that Instagram has been really bad about putting in front of everybody fake people who you don't know where their money comes from. I mean, sometimes it's actually false, the narratives they're creating. Sometimes they're nepo babies, whatever it is. But they're living lives where they're flying globally on business class all the time and making it seem like that's what you should do if you're a middle-class person. And then you don't know how much money you should be spending. So all those things are messed up. But also, if you think about Rockefellers, the Rockefellers came up, obviously had a lot of conflict probably with the old money system, but then what did Rockefeller have his kids do? They just went around the world spending the money on charities, paying for the Asia Society and I believe the Japan Society, the Asia Cultural Council, Howard University. Like, the Rockefellers gave all their money away in a sense because there was some sort of social responsibility and because there was a existing system of society that he was trying to put himself into. Now all these billionaires are just saying, we can just go off and build our own society. We can trash the society that all the rest of you are in. We can have our own society. And so that, and they have so much money that they can do it.
They can build a bunker in New Zealand.
In New Zealand, yeah. And so I think that is also, there's just a lot of distorting factors that aren't simply that they have more political influence. It's just that they're making us feel about ourselves different, and they're wrecking any chance of kind of a working social system.
That's interesting. I mean, perhaps I tend to see what you describe as a symptom of a problem, right? And so we come back to the problem, and this is where I guess we can use different lenses to try and analyze it. And I'm very interested, again, in this history of neoliberalism, but the other piece is the history of money. And again, one of the key aspects of neoliberalism was the floating of currencies, the removing of limits on current accounts and foreign exchange and these kinds of things. I mean, once upon a time, if you wanted to get foreign exchange to go on a trip from New Zealand to the United States, you had to write a letter to the central bank.
Right.
This is the kind of stuff that was quite common. And, you know, when that got untethered, unbundled, we saw a whole lot of things start happening. And I do wonder whether the nature of money, the role of the state in money, the role of commercial banking, these kinds of things, in some historical sense, have led to where we are today. Because you do write a little bit about Occupy Wall Street, mm-hmm. and how that 2008 moment of, you know, well, what's going to happen? Are they going to bail these banks out? That really that was an opportunity maybe to revisit the steam train of history that was kind of coming towards us. And yet nothing really changed. They bailed the banks out. A few of them kind of failed on paper, but everyone still got their bonuses.
Within a year, yeah.
Yeah. Have you reflected perhaps on, say Occupy Wall Street, but this bigger question of the nature of money and the changes around money and the state's role in money over the decades?
Again, that's, I don't think about things at that level just because I can't think about everything. But I guess, I mean, to me, money, I'm interested in money as signal, as, you know, and those signals are really key for culture. And where money is, you know, the thing that happens when people start making money is they immediately, after some income level, you're only buying positional goods, right? Like at some point you're buying comfort and buying a nicer house and nicer and clothes.
That status.
And at some point you have to start marking status. Yeah. And that's what you're using all the rest of your money for. And one of the things about, again, being a millionaire versus being a billionaire is that there's a $1 million car, right? There's not a $1 billion car. And so at some point you make so much money that you're actually...
The one that goes like this or the one that goes like that.
But I think that's not $1 billion, you know? And so at some point you start going beyond positional goods. You have so much money that positional goods don't make any sense anymore. And so money, the kind of the globalized world that we live in, and especially after the tech revolution, it just puts so much money in people's hands that... it becomes, again, a distortion on culture, and these people in some ways become miserable. I mean, I think that's what's really interesting, is how miserable Elon Musk seems despite being the richest person in the world, and how much sore winner disease there is. I mean, and Kanye has that, Elon Musk has that.
For what shall it profit a man if it shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? And we're in this world where, as you say, these people, they're on there with their T-shirts and their rants on X, and yet they seem like deeply miserable people in some situations, some cases. It's all there for us to see. And in a sense, you write quite a lot about reality TV in your book, you know, the phenomena of the Kardashians, Paris Hilton, these people, their lives are out there for us to observe, to be voyeuristic towards. And yet now... the highest levels of society, these the richest people in the world, their every thought is being broadcast to us 140 characters at a time. And it, in a lot of ways, it's revealing its incoherence. I saw an interview with, I think it was like the ex-girlfriend of Elon Musk, Grimes. I don't know if you're familiar. And nothing she said made any sense whatsoever. It was like she's just living in this highfalutin, you know, fantasy land, and you think, okay, these are the most powerful, richest people in the world in some cases. And that's, I don't know, it's quite revealing. It's almost like the curtain's been pulled away, that you're seeing this.
But I mean, I think for all of them, they're of the belief, and the system would give them this, the belief, that if they have the most money, they should have the most status. And what does status mean? I mean, status is it means nothing to you if you walk into a room and people make fun of you. The whole point of having status is to get this natural form of esteem from people, and you get benefits that people go out of their way to treat you well when you have high status. And so for Elon Musk to be mocked as much as he's being mocked, I think it really does drive him crazy, because he can't figure out, why is it that I have all the money and that I don't have all the respect? And it goes, I think, with all these people. And that's where you get the sore winner kind of ethos, is that they have all the money, but they can't convert it quickly enough to esteem, because they can't do the one thing that would actually give them esteem, which is to provide for society.
And yeah, the magnanimous philosopher king.
Yeah.
Which again, comes back to a sense of maybe perhaps a deeper cultural connection, perhaps a social contract with the people around you, and a sense of belonging and place. And again, I wonder whether that is not the pendulum that we see swinging, and it's quite perhaps chaotic at the moment, but a sense of belonging, a sense of being of a place and time, not just another global consumer. But look, David, I want to maybe talk just on a bit more of a positive note, because you do outline some solutions, solutions is perhaps not quite the right word, but some maybe the ways we can think about culture moving forward, and something we can maybe keep in mind. So maybe you could give me an idea of sort of what should we keep in mind when thinking about the culture around us, especially for people who are creatives, people who are working on, in the creative world. Like,
yeah, I mean, the first thing that's very important is to understand what I call creative invention as a social good. That it is important to optimize our actions at individual level, but also to work towards that at a social level. And in the past, we haven't had to do that because there's just people out there who don't need to be told that this, they're doing the right thing. They just were inventive, and then the system tended to support that invention, and it wasn't maybe because of some sort of benevolence, but just the particular state of the system. So the first thing is, yeah, to understand it as a social good. So then if you're optimizing for that social good, that means that if you're a creator, you have to stop. I mean, selling out is really kind of a cudgel way of saying it, but instead of for yourself looking at your creative work and saying, how can I alter it to meet the market better so that more people will enjoy it, so I'll get more ad revenue or whatever the thing you're doing, to really focus on how can I try to make the most inventive thing. And inventive is a little ambiguous, and I know that everyone's going to take it a different way. But ultimately, again, if you go back to the idea that the story of human, and I think progress is the wrong word, but just the story of humans is told through new methods of artistic practice and new attempts at aesthetics and these things. So if you're doing creative work, that should be your goal, is that you should be trying to do something new and do something good. And so first of all, maximizing for that. And so that means also to value those things, you need to fight the temptation of not just the market, but also having these market ideologies get into your head, which is that I made an incredibly good TikTok. It only got 200 views. Then it must be a bad TikTok, because a good TikTok has 200,000 views or a million views or whatever. And so you also have to fight that temptation, and you need to put yourself in a community that is going to value the work that you do, and you're going to be able to resonate with that community, but also just you can value your own work in opposition. And so to me, that is the number one thing missing at the moment. It's not that there's no creativity. And I'm very confident that there's people out there trying to do really cool stuff. It's simply that if the market's not valuing them, which also has happened in the past, and that's not new, it's that you have to have the confidence to say the market is wrong. We're right, the market is wrong. And that's what every subculture had, that's what every counterculture had, and that's what avant-garde artists had. So it's to rebuild and have the confidence in these communities, however that works, to stop internalizing these market dynamics,
yeah,
and to really get excited about the thing you're doing that is more artistically and creative minded as the goal and in itself, not as a step to make money. Because if you want to make money, you can just go work for an insurance company and then do art on the side.
Yeah, I've got here, so what you wrote, cultural invention, creative invention, doesn't require government funding or mass persuasion. It begins inside small but influential creative communities. Yep. And I cast my mind back to where I am here in Kamakura, talking about the friends that I've got around me, the creative people, the kind of sense of a vibe here that's kind of hyper-local to this place. You think about the origins of punk rock and these other historical movements that are very much associated with a place.
Yep.
And it's quite cool to think that, okay, we still have that. We can go and meet up with our friends and create. And that is with us still. And so there's an opportunity there to create. And as you say, sometimes the market doesn't know. It's trying to flatten out in its analytics the idea of, well, what is the perfect YouTube video? And in particular, AI is also playing into this. You know,
yep,
you've got kind of the average, the mean, but in fact going way out and coming at it from the edges, like these historical trends, these historical creative projects, it's actually quite a powerful place. And in its sense, that has its own kind of transgression, which is quite powerful. And I think it's quite exciting, man. So you're based in Japan. I mean, do you think about these things maybe differently from your perspective here in Japan? Does it affect the way you sort of look back at your home in the United States where you grew up?
Yeah, if you just take this perspective, let's say neoliberalism, because it's kind of a boogeyman word. And I think that it also, you get very quickly into conspiratorial thinking.
Oh, yeah.
But let's say instead it's just a bunch of policies that led to a certain situation. And then to me, let's also say it's extending capitalist logic to every part of the human experience, which is easy when, you know, especially when a smartphone lets you take every single thing that you do every day and turn it into an app which can be monetized. And so all these things put pressure on us to think about our lives. We're personal brands now, we're not people. And to think about all of our actions in terms of in this capitalist logic. One of the things about Japan is that it doesn't have that. That it has some of it, because everywhere has some of it. But there's still a sense that there are cultural hierarchies and orders that have nothing to do with capitalism. And that I truly believe that the reason people come here and as tourists and enjoy it is because they haven't experienced that in a long time. And it's quite simple. I mean, even if you put it in economic terms, which is that for every market, there is a consumer surplus and a producer surplus. And the idea of, you know, having a equalized market price is to try to, make them equal. There is, in Japan, when you go to a really nice restaurant, especially before kind of inflation a couple of years ago, you would go to that restaurant and you would pay something almost way too reasonable and have an incredibly high quality experience. And your sense of it is that the consumer surplus is being given back to me as the customer, that they should be charging more, but they're not, out of a sense of respect. And that person running the restaurant isn't doing it to make a lot of money, because if they were, they would be doing it in a different way. And so when you see people operating more from a craftsperson point of view, and it's important to know, traditionally in Japanese culture, there was a line between craftspeople and merchants. They were different class in the Tokugawa era, and that value system is maintained, which is if you make something, you want to be a craftsperson, you don't want to be a merchant. So craftspeople go out of their way to not look like they're profiteering. So your experience in a restaurant or going to a store is that I'm not being ripped off. And if you go to the United States, every experience you have is that was way too expensive for what it was, or I'm being upsold, or they made business class to be the normal level so that and when you're in an economy, they actually make it worse to punish you, to force you to, you know, want to be in business class or something. So when you get to Japan, that logic is just hasn't taken over everything. And so you get a glimpse of there's a different way for humans to operate. You could look at the restaurant owner and say, wow, he's being exploited in a sense that he should be making more money than he is. But that person is getting the esteem for being a well-regarded crafts person at the thing that they do. And the customer's getting a great experience and everyone's happy. And that I feel like that is still going on way more in Japan than it is elsewhere.
It's interesting you mention that, though, because fundamentally these small businesses, those people own the means of production in that sense. And so it seems to me the criticism you have is really a criticism of shareholder capitalism and the kind of format we see in the United States where everything's a Starbucks or a McDonald's, whereas a small craftsman running a soba, a noodle place,
right,
making some leather bags or something, you know, that person's able to do that within a capitalist framework, but without maybe the same kinds of market pressures you get from...
Yeah, you don't have to give the surplus to the shareholders.
Yeah.
Or you don't say, okay, we acquired your bag company for $200 million and now you have that debt. And now we need you to make much more money to pay back the debt that we did to make this acquisition.
And just on that note, for both of us in Japan here, there's a really good book called Princes of the Yen, which talks about the history of Japanese central banking. And It was interesting because in the Taishō era, there was actually a very strong, basically American-style shareholder capitalism in Japan. And in the lead-up to the war, they basically shut down that because, you know, who was going to go along with it? And so even today, shareholdings is not really a way to make money in Japan. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to... Startups don't really monetize in the same way here. Yeah. There's all these other effects. And so I think there's some... And perhaps for another conversation for another time, but it's quite interesting, that different approach of the way the Japanese kind of regulated out the ability to really kind of have that fat cat shareholder capitalism like you saw in the 1920s in Japan prior to the war, yet which is, you know, de jure here in the United States. So kind of interesting criticisms there, maybe more room for thought. But I think overall this idea of the blank space is quite profound. I'm reminded, I don't know, are you familiar with the British band Sig Sig Sputnik? Do you remember from the
80s, yeah.
I got here, stereo, video, sci-fi, sex, let's go, go, go. The cultural logic of capitalism, of neoliberalism, very interesting. You've certainly explored it with your book, and you sort of close on this idea that we have created blank space, and now that we can see it, it's time to rebuild, which I think is quite a hopeful message. You know, there is an opportunity. We have all the technology now, the fact that I can do something like this.
Yeah.
I can afford all this gear. Once upon a time, I would have taken a television station. Now we can do it, you know, do it ourselves, DIY. It seems like having a little bit of that means of production in our own hands means we can do a lot of stuff, right?
I mean, on the other side, and this is kind of the, again, this is a really pessimistic point of view, to be honest, but there's this weird tension, in, let's say in the late 90s, where getting access to the means of production is still difficult. It's easier. So take Kevin Smith, who made Clerks, and he needed to max out all these credit cards to get the $25,000 to get the film, right? Now, I mean, he would have the video, he could do it on an iPhone and it would be fine. But the fact that he made a film, he's competing against almost nobody because nobody can get access to a film. And so Clerks gets all this attention, and there's something really valuable about it because you're like, wow, this kid made this in a convenience store that he worked in. And so the problem is the rarity of the means of production ends up making the thing more valuable. And it's the same with like techno or you know, electronic music from the 80s or 90s, which is that it was hard to get a 909 or a 303 or all this equipment that you needed. Like you needed to know a guy or you needed to have it, and it was pretty expensive. And now you can get clones of this stuff for free, you get the soft synths, and everything that's created is just less valuable because it's easier to make. And so there's two problems where that I touched a little bit less about the book, but there's inherent damages to value in the democratization, in the sense of everybody has access to something, the creation itself becomes less valuable, just inherently. But then also, because of this, the way that we monetize all this stuff and what success looks like, there are more people jumping in to create for reasons other than exploration of the form itself. So think about YouTube. You've got a mech, you've got this thing where anybody could make visual content and put it online. So my image, I worked at YouTube in the early 2010s. And the reason I was excited about YouTube is like, wow, this is the thing that I wished happened in the 90s, which is that anybody could distribute their film for free. But then what actually became popular on YouTube was not film. It was people talking to the camera, saying, I went to Forever 21 and here's the clothes that I bought. And it's not to take anything away from that because that connected to people, but it's just a different form. It's not artistically minded. It's if I build a big audience, I can monetize that audience and then I can make it into a career. So you attract all these people into the system who aren't there to be creative in the first place. And again, it's not to say they're bad people or they're greedy. It's just that that's the mechanism. And so then you crowd out the people who are there to be creative. And I think younger people also, their experience with visual media and media is with the commerce-minded or careerist kind of media, not with the artistic media. So they're not even inspired necessarily by the people who are doing the weird stuff. They're inspired by the people who are doing the mainstream stuff. So I think that's the other issue, is that yes, we do have access to this stuff, but we have to find a new way to revalue people using it to be creative rather than to use it to be careerist.
Okay, we've got to look for a transformational value of some sense. And perhaps what we need is gatekeepers again.
But I mean, gatekeepers only work if you care about being on the other side of the gate, right? Yeah. So if you have a bunch of snobs who are like, oh, we're only going to be interested in this one thing, but then those snobs don't have any status, well, then the thing inside doesn't have any status. Yeah. I mean, what you need is some natural mechanism just to say that the where the high status people are is offline, or it's not this stuff, it's something else. I think that's naturally happening. I mean, I think
who's high status in your eyes?
I mean, that's also really one of the issues of the era, which is that I don't think anyone agrees on what high status means, but also because money's distorted this so much. And so if you go, this is something I've noticed quite recently, if you go to a really fancy hotel anywhere around the world, so I was just in Paris, I stepped inside a fancy hotel, it's beautiful, and you have an ideal customer in your head. You have the heritage of the brand and who you think would be there. And what you think, would be there is someone whose taste, personal tastes match the hotel. But the thing is, these hotels, because they have to cater to the richest people, someone with good taste probably can't afford to stay there. So the number of people who have really good taste and all of that money, because all this money has been generated in the last 20 years, is almost nobody. So when you walk around, what you see is everyone there is from I don't know if you're allowed to use the term third world country anymore, but a developing nation who is probably the children or the grandchildren of a factory owner.
The Chinese people, you mean?
I mean, and I don't just mean China, but like China is a big source of this, but they could be from Kazakhstan or Pakistan.
And the
live streaming
and
But you walk around and you say, okay, they are people. I'm trying to say this as politically sensitive as possible, but they're people who do not bring the taste. They're not bringing taste and matching it. They are people who. I have all this money. What am I going to do with it? What's the most expensive hotel? I'm going to stay there. And so the problem is you just create this very distorted luxury market. So luxury used to be the natural goods of high status people. And now because of the market, because the shareholder driven companies, they have to be the most expensive goods, but the most expensive goods in an era of wealth explosion can never be the most tasteful goods.
Yeah. And it sounds like you're referencing globalism as well there.
Yeah. Yeah.
We've got, you know, China is maybe the one that stands out where, you know, entering into the World Trade Organization in the 90s made all these people incredibly rich. Now we're seeing their children and grandchildren being able to fly around the world, again, live streaming on TikTok and buying the gaudiest luxury fashion.
Right.
Yeah, perhaps without our sense of a historical sense of taste. I mean, maybe in their eyes there's taste. And I don't know, man, it's a hard one, right? Because, yeah, that's what we've landed with, neoliberalism, globalism. It's all kind of played out in this way.
But if you're in that system and you're going around saying, well, who has high status? And you know, there's people who are cultural tastemakers who I have infinite respect for their taste, they know the right people. You know, they have all the cultural capital, all the social capital. But I know them, but I bet those people don't even feel like they have high status because we live in a world in which so much of status is based on economic and financial holdings. And those people tend not to have a lot of social capital and cultural capital at the moment. So if you're in this period, it's one thing when new money, it has enough money to be like old money. And it's different when new money has 1,000 to 1,000,000 times more money than old money. And the old money becomes, in a sense, irrelevant. And that's where we are at the moment.
Yeah, maybe we need to bring back the aesthetics of poverty a little bit. And, you know, the humble, what was it? Quiet lux, I think they call it.
Yeah. But quiet luxury was an attempt that there was, that luxury had gotten so gaudy with the new money consumer that some of the, let's call them mid money. It's like they're kind of all, they're one step away from new money. They wanted to have a quieter kind of luxury. So, but I, if it's confusing, it's because it is confusing. I don't think anyone, you know, Elon Musk, they're getting the same. It's that by one measure, Elon Musk should be the highest status person in the world, but he's also a buffoon.
But he's not. Yeah. Interesting. Status, money, all these questions. I'm interested, though, for you, just sort of wrapping up, David, the rest of this year, you've just pushed this book out. You're talking to everyone who will listen, including myself, about what it is you're thinking here. But, I mean, What's next for you, man? What are you working on after this? What's your outlook?
So I've done 3 books in 10 years, and I did 2 in 3 years especially. And so I'm trying to use this year to take a step back and not push myself to do another book. I have a general sense of what I want to do next, which I will not reveal at the moment, but I want to work towards that kind of slowly and to set it up to write next year rather than write this year.
Yeah.
I edit a magazine called The New Japan, which is really focused on regional Japan. And that's been exciting just because I think there's so much deep culture outside of the big cities. And so that's been an interesting process. But I mean, I guess to me too, it's, I think Blank Space really had a negative impact on my mental health, to be perfectly. I brought it upon myself, so I don't need a lot of sympathy, but in the sense of, I mean, I wrote it really fast, but also just thinking at that scale is hard because I want to be completist. It's almost impossible to be completist. And I mean, there's things in the book that I completely forgot to write about. I think food, it would have been really, really good to write more about food. Gaming, maybe a little bit more about prestige TV, et cetera, et cetera. But having to wake up every day and think about the news because it's like, well, that's going to have to go in the book. I think it was just too much. It's too much information. And so I'm trying to find... I think last year radicalized me in the sense, and I think I feel like I share this with a lot of people, which is we have put the internet in our lives as much as it could ever be put in our lives. I think we've maxed out. There's no more living even more online. The phone does everything that it kind of is going to do for us until a new form factor comes along. And so I'm trying to figure out how to rebalance my life in being offline more, connecting with friends more, going places, doing interesting things, taking the time to read, to rethink, not just recycle through, okay, everyone's writing about Labubu, I have to write about Labubu, but to really go back into books, find new ideas, repair, give myself a year. But the thing I'm noticing is, and this is what I'm kind of, I'm trying to take my own advice, but finding why it's difficult is because the logic of culture is just so online and it's so much about scale. And if you do smaller things, you have to convince yourself it will pay off in the future. And it's very, very hard to do that.
Maybe we're entering into the age of the contrarian. I mean, I certainly, not that many people listen to this particular show, but you know, when I do meet my listeners, I often become friends with them. There's a small community of us. And it's interesting. I also don't usually have a SIM card. So I have my phone. If I need to, I'll find a Wi-Fi hotspot. But
yep.
I've just that one act, not having a SIM card, has been quite interesting over the last year. And people think, oh, there's no way I could do that. How could I survive? And I think, oh, you know.
We used to. I mean, I remember, yeah, I mean, it was not that long ago where your life was, if you were at home, you were online. And then you were out, you were not online. And I mean, and one of the things I've noticed too is just if you work... for companies, especially a startup, and they're on Slack, the response time that is required for a Slack message, inherently culturally, I mean, there's no rule, but the cultural expectation is within seconds, if not minutes.
Yeah.
And an email, it's maybe days. And that also makes a really big, big impact. And so the problem, I was in China last year and I didn't have my VPN failed, and so I was just basically couldn't use any of the apps and couldn't talk to anybody. And as I was going through the city, I would just not even look at my phone because like the phone was a brick basically. And so I got to enjoy China, and that was great. So that in one way, I realized, okay, if I didn't have a phone, I would be much more in the moment. That was good. On the other side, I realized I was stressed out because I don't know what people are asking of me. I can't. There's all these demands being put on me. That when I open my phone, every message I get is more or less a request. And because everything is a request, I'm not fulfilling those requests. And so it's piling up. So I started getting stressed out about, I can't fulfill my social obligations to people. And so phones are not simply distraction machines, which is what everyone complains about, but they're social obligation machines. And so we also have to completely reset the social obligation we put on each other. That if you send someone a message on WhatsApp, that you don't immediately expect a response.
Yeah, Yeah. And just one maybe thing we can finish on, David. I was thinking, you know, reading your book, reflecting on myself on what I've seen over the last a few years, as especially I think COVID was an inflection point for this kind of terminally online situation that a lot of people find themselves in. But this looming blank space of your book, are you not describing perhaps the same hole that Nietzsche saw 150 years ago with the death of God in our society, perhaps this idea that we're sort of reaching for something, we're trying to find it in the dark, and yet we've known for some time that God is dead, God remains dead, and we have killed him?
That's interesting. I mean, I think the part that I'm also struggling with, and I don't know how much this parallels to what Nietzsche is describing, is the glee that people are feeling in some ways about the world we're in. That there are people who want something out of culture they're not getting. And then there are people who are telling everyone else, then something's wrong with you. And, you know, in writing the book too, a lot of the critiques are, well, if you can't find anything good, something must be wrong with you. And in it's frustrating because the book isn't, it actually is not a book about how everything is bad. And that there's nothing good. It's much more about the value shift than it is just a litany of how everything's terrible. And I'll give you an example, something like Vampire Weekend, which is the first two albums of Vampire Weekend, I really enjoy. I think it's great music, but Vampire Weekend is more commercially oriented than bands like them from 20 years earlier. And that's the thing I was trying to highlight, not whether it's good or not. And so, one of the, whether, you know, culture is dead or there's this hole and we're all having to admit that there's this hole, I think what has not been helpful is this sense that, and I got this a little bit, but I think people feel this when you complain that or you point out that there may be something wrong, that it's seen as you must have ill intention in pointing out that you must hate Taylor Swift, you know, if you hate Taylor Swift, you hate the female fans of Taylor Swift. I don't even hate Taylor Swift. I just don't want it only to be Taylor Swift, you know? And so I think that's the other part of it. And I don't know, in Nietzsche's days where people were saying, well, God is dead, but you have to celebrate the fact that God is dead. Or, I mean, maybe that's his point. I don't know. I don't know enough about it to go completely parallel, but I do know that it's been interesting to write this book, which I think if you feel is obvious, you feel is obvious. And yet there was so much resistance towards, there must be something wrong with you, the author, to have come to this conclusion. And how much of the criticism, rather than just saying yes, but, or yes, and, has been no, or completely delegitimizing to say you shouldn't think this way or write this book at all.
Yeah. And you've mentioned how you're going to take maybe a bit of a break after this. Your efforts, your energies have been put into this thing that's so hyper now, hyper connected. Have you transformed for a positive, though, in any ways after coming through this? Is there anything that you take away from the book?
I do think just taking a moment to say, okay, this is what happened in the 25 years, and the creeping logic of capitalism in our brains.
In your brain, though, or everyone?
I mean, I would argue that everybody's a victim of this. I mean, not everybody, but it's the most people are victims of this. You have to make a mental you have to recognize that that's going on, and then from that recognition, you can make positive change. I'm a very big believer in a kind of skeptical optimism, which is to understand the real situation, to not take the PR hype about something in the most idealized version of it, but understand the real cynical motivations of people and become skeptical about what the system's really doing. But only in doing that can you look for solutions. And so for me personally, I had to get through this is what I think is happening and it's not good and I didn't love reporting on it. But now that I understand that, I understand some ways to get out of it and to get myself out of it.
Okay. David Marks, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for listening. I am Cody Allingham, and that was The Transformation of Value. If you would like to support this show, please consider making a donation either through my website or by directly tipping to the show's Bitcoin wallet, or just pass this episode on to a friend who you think may enjoy it. And you can always email me at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com.